So we left off last week on Daf Lamed Aleph from a days, and we were talking about the Hilchasa Gibirasa Dechana, the very important laws of Tefillah that we can learn from our ancestors, Dechana, and her prayer for that was eventually answered, who would become Shmuel Hanavi. So last week we read through the Gemara until several lines down Lamed Aleph from a days, and now I wanted to go back and look at some of the passages in the Shulchan Aruch that are actually relevant to this. So the first one, which is rather daunting and challenging, but I think at least worth considering, and I think it's particularly challenging in the world in which we live, where most of us on some level multitask, we have many different things going on, we have something like this which makes it very easy to have us attached to those many tasks. But the Shulchan Aruch writes the following, and this is in response, or this is commenting or quoting the Gemara on the bottom of Lamed Aleph Amud Aleph, where Rav Hamnuna said, the first one is, Mikan l'miskat mispalosh that tzarech sheicha v'nes libo. As we explained, it doesn't just mean, it's easy to have kavana to be yotzei tefillah. I go to shul, I know why I'm going to shul. I start the Amidah, I know I'm doing the Amidah to fulfill the mitzvah tefillah. But it really means to be attention to what he's saying, to be focused on prayer, to be focused on connecting to God. So the Shulchan Aruch, and this is the first source on the sheet, and Lenny, I believe you sent this out. Hamispalel tzarech sheyichavein belibo peirush hamilos shemotzi b'sfasav. That a person is supposed to should be thinking about the words that they are articulating, because most of us can, in fact, daven in a manner which we refer to as mitzvah hanashim melumada, prayer by rote. So a person really should be focused on the words that they are uttering. V'yachshov ki'ilu shchina kenegdo. You should imagine, envision as if you're in the divine presence. Mi'osir kol ha'machshavos ha'tardos oso. You should remove all of your distractions, all the things that are, I don't know what there goes, tumult in you, if there is such, there's no such verb, but that are creating tumult for you. They're tardos. Until your thoughts and your focus is pure, limited to your tefillah. You should imagine that if you were speaking, imagine, even to the President of the United States, even though he's not a king, I've never actually met a president, but I imagine if you meet the President, you experience a degree of trepidation. And if you're going to say something, you probably rehearsed what you're going to say before. I would love if Rabbi Lookstein is not in here right now, but I would love to ask him, his impression. I'm sure he has met a number of presidents, and I imagine that he has rehearsed what he's going to say to the president, because you A, have a limited audience, B, you don't want to make a fool of yourself, even in front of the President of the United States.
There's a well-known story about Moshe Feinstein, who used to shuckle a lot during davening, and then he met Governor Rockefeller at a certain point, and he realized that when he spoke to Governor Rockefeller, he stood up straight in trepidation and did not shuffle when he was talking to him, and ever since then it's happened.
Very, very interesting. Where is this story printed?
I remember hearing it, seeing it or hearing it.
I would love to see
it.
Okay.
It's a great story. Even if it's not true, it's a great story.
This is true. Not all things, well, as I like to say, even some things that never happened are true. So we'll leave it at that. So he should think that if he were in front of a human king, the person would be experiencing trepidation, would be careful what he would say or she would say. Kal v'chomer lefnei melech malche hamlochim hakadosh baruch hu shehu choker kol ha'machshavos. Certainly in the presence of God, who understands everything that we're thinking, we should have that sense. V'yekach hayu asosim chasidim v'anshei maisa. The pious ones and the people of great deeds, shehayu misbodedim, they would engage in hispodedus. They would, in fact, we would say meditation. Umechavnim mitfilasam. They would be focused on really preparing for prayer. Ad shehayu magim lehispashtus hagashmus, until they reach the stage of basically having stripped away their physical being. Ulehiskavrus koach hasichli, and having their intellect, their cognitive, their focus overpower everything. Ad shehayu magiyin karov lemayla sanavua, until they had reached almost, not quite, but almost to the stage of prophecy. V'im tava lo machsheva acheres b'toch ha'tfila. I find personally sometimes it's easy to start, and it's a good idea, I can't say I do it most of the time, but I certainly do it some of the time, to start the Amida focused on the tfila, and at some point you get one bracha, you think I've accomplished something, two brachas, and at some point the stuff, your day stuff going on, it could be important things and good things, and it could be divrei mitzvah and divrei Torah and good things you're going to do in the world, but they kind of start just seeping in. And it really requires enormous focus of mind, which I suspect is a rare quantity in our world in which we live in order to sort of push those things out. But he says, "Im tava lo machsheva acheres b'socha tfila, yishtok ad shetisbatel hamachshava," which would really be a tremendously challenging thing. I think I would find that my Amida would take a very, very long time. If I could catch myself in those moments where my mind has strayed, again, it could be about very good things, you know, divrei mitzvah, divrei, you know, divrei Torah, nonetheless, to stop until a person can focus. The tzarech sheyachshav bedvarim hamachniyim halev. One should be thinking, presumably before tefillah, about things that induce humility, umechaven oso la'avish shebashamayim, and direct one's focus to one's Father in heaven. Velo yachshav bedvarim sheyesh b'em kalas rosh. One should not be thinking about matters of levity. And the Rama adds, and I'm not sure he's really adding as much as restating, the yachshav kodem hatfila meiromim musael yisale. One should think about God's loftiness, God's greatness, God's transcendence, but God's being above uveshiflas haadam, and in the lowest human beings being in the lowest being very low. The yasir kol tanuge haadam milibo. A person should remove all thoughts of pleasures from one's heart, which is really the same thing as hispashtus agashmus, trying to sort of separate oneself from the physical dimension. And then the Shulchan Aruch says, the Ramah says something really, really fascinating, but I think really, really important, and something that I will comment on, although it really could be probably an hour-long sichas musar, but that's not generally what we're doing in Sunday morning shir. The Ramah quotes from the Aguda, Arishon, v'asur la'adam l'nashek banav hakanim b'beis haknesses. A person is not allowed, is prohibited to kiss one's children in the beis haknesses. K'dei l'kvoa b'libo shein ava k'avas hamakom. In order to set or instill in one's own heart that there is no love that in this world that should compare to one's love of God. And I think actually that this particular line in the Ramah buried here in a siman that most of us only aspire to, maybe one of the most, it actually expresses one of the most sublime truths about religion in general and Yahadus. I'd like to say, often quote the opening passage in the Aruch HaShulchan on Aruch Chaim, where the Aruch HaShulchan basically, in my terms, describes our existence as a struggle between our angelic side and our animal side. There are manners, the Gemara in Chagiga says, there are ways in which we are like the Malachi Asharis, and there are ways we are like the rest of the animal kingdom. And the goal of a religious individual is to try to stress more, not asceticism, to be a little bit more like the angels, little less like the animals. The idea of caring for one's children, I don't think to anybody who's a parent is very hard to understand. We give almost everything for our children. Parents will give their lives for their children. But this particular impulse, which is, generally speaking, almost all the time a good thing, is not unique to human beings. The most dangerous time, probably the most common situation in this region when people can be attacked by bears, is when the mama bear is protecting her cubs. And this is true with many species in the animal kingdom, this urge to protect our young, to do what we need for our young, but in certain sense, that really is, you might call it a Darwinian impulse, right? To pass on our genes, to make sure our genes are perpetuated. And generally speaking, that's unobjectionable in halacha. There are many responsibilities we have towards our children that are codified in halacha. That's all wonderful. But there can arise situations in which there is a conflict between loyalties. There's a conflict between loyalty, let's say, to our children, and loyalty to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And a true religious personality, again, those conflicts are rare. But when faced with that type of a conflict, what the Rama is teaching us here, and I don't think this is a contested principle, is that our loyalties to the Ribbono Shel Olam come first. This is true not only with respect to our children. It's true with respect to even when we think about martyrdom. We think about Yehori Vayavo, giving one's life over certain averus. I think that in modern secular society, while I think most people would understand that, I think they would definitely understand that you can't kill someone else to save your own life. I don't know how many people in secular America would understand that if someone were putting a gun to your head and asking you to accept Jesus at the baptismal font or any other religion, the idea that a truly observant Jew would give up one's life rather than do that. Or even, I mean, less, more of an odd situation, not something that typically occurred historically, but the same holds true with Givei Arayos, with the whole gamut of prohibited sexual relations, from incest to adultery and anything else that would be included in that. The idea that one would give up one's life rather than violate a particular avera is something foreign, I think, to most of secular American culture. But that idea, and remember, 97% of the time, maybe 99% of the time, when faced with a challenge of a danger to life and a mitzvah of the Torah, so the Torah says, v'chai b'hem, that we opt for life because that's what God commanded us, that life is precious. And most of the time, we set aside mitzvos in order to preserve life. But there are certain principles, there are certain averos that are so significant, that are so severe, that we choose our loyalty to God over our own lives. That's what our ancestors did for centuries when faced with religious persecutions. Not everybody, but you can read the stories. We've spoken about this years ago in doing Maseches Avodah Zarah, of the parents during the Crusades who slaughtered their own children before killing themselves rather than allow them to be taken, to be baptized as Christians. And that, while that particular issue, allowing oneself to be killed, that's simple in halacha, killing one's children is much more complicated. But nonetheless, it reflects an impulse and a perspective that there are things that are more important than our lives and our children's lives. And that is our loyalty to God. That is what a true religious personality is. And so when we, you know, this is not such a difficult thing to do. Well, can be difficult, but one has to remind oneself that the idea that when we're in the Beis HaKnesses, that we are focused on the Ribono Shel, we don't kiss our children. It doesn't mean we don't guide them, but we don't express certain kinds of emotions because it's to remind us that our loyalty to God comes before our loyalty to anyone else, self, spouse, siblings, children. That's not something I think that comes easily, but I think that really is a central principle of the full and complete religious personality. Okay. On a lighter note, moving on to the next halacha that is learned, which is that you're supposed to be mashmiya la'oznav. In the words of the Gemara, I should say, ayach toch b'sfasav. You're supposed to not just think the words of what you're davening, but you're supposed to articulate the words. So the Shulchan Aruch writes in Simen Kuf Aleph Sif Beis, lo yispalo belibo levad, el mechatech hadvarim b'sfasav, Umashnia la'ozna balachash. So you're not supposed to daven only internally, but you're supposed to articulate the words and quietly make it audible to your ears. V'lo yashmiya kolo, that's the next line in the Gemara, mikan she'osur lahagbia kol betilasa. You're not allowed to raise your voice when you're davening. So v'eino yochol l'chavein balachash, but the Mechaber says, if you're not able to concentrate when you are, if it's done totally quietly, sometimes it does help to have some noise, have some sound. Mutter lahagbia kolo, one is allowed to raise one's voice, but vahani mili beino levenatzmo, only if you're alone. Aval betzibur osur, the osi lemitrad tzibura, because it's going to distract other people who are trying to daven. Now the Rama comes along and says something interesting. He says, v'imashmiya, and the Rama adds that if you're doing it in your house, in order to teach the members of your household, that would be most likely your children, how you daven, so then that is acceptable as well. I believe the Acharon talk about something interesting here, which is the question of when everybody has Siddurim. It's not in the Shulchan Aruch, but if everybody has Siddurim, is the issue as big an issue because people are davening out of a sitter, so they're able to continue their tefillah, your tefillah is not going to interrupt them. that's true on the one hand when you're talking about, it is much harder to have kavana in your tefillah when you don't have a sitter, when you have to remember the words, when someone else is distracting you. On the other hand, it could be argued that nonetheless, when you're trying to focus on your davening, not just the words, so somebody else's tefillah out loud can be rather distracting.
So that often does happen. There's one or two people who are very loud, the whole shul together. There are even, communities where the whole shul is making a cacophony, right? So, no?
I've learned, I only speak to my own experience. To me, at least the shul in which I daven, it's us. Okay, so there are cultures that are different, but at least, I don't know if in modern Orthodox shuls that's a reflection of respect for the Shulchan Aruch or simply an indication of our tepid, passion when it comes to tefillah. But either way, I haven't really experienced that. In KJ, do you experience that? Okay. I don't want to say I've never heard such a thing. I usually, occasionally, maybe, but I don't think our, I think in the shul in which, shuls in which I dive, even in the YU-based medrash, right? And there, I would say it's not, however one wants to analyze it sociologically, psychologically, it's not tepid for many of those students. They are passionate. It's quiet. You go, Yamar Noroyim, you can be in the base medrash during the Amida. And after the Amida, even when people have finished, you could hear a pin drop. So I'm not saying, I don't know if Hasidic Shtibels have a different culture, there are always exceptions, but I've been, most of the places in which I've davened, I don't really, unless I'm not centered, I don't hear anything. During the Amida. Yeah. They're probably Amida, okay. That's the issue, but we're only talking about the Amida here. Right, with this communal singing, but there's other stuff when you're answering Amen Yehi Shmei Rabbah, you go to the YU based Medrash, some of you, David, may remember the certain voices, Yehi Shmei Rabbah, that still ring in your ears. You know who it is who really took the Gemara and Brachos that we learned earlier to heart, that anyone who says Yehi Shmei Rabbah with his full strength, their Kore Lo Gzardinav Shivim Shana. So come visit the YU based Medrash on it. Once, you could come up for a mincha, and what? Say Yeheshme Rabba b'chol kocho, there'll be karlo afilu gzardin shel shivim shana, even a gzardin of suffering for 70 years. It's I think the Gemara is in the first parak. We saw it a while ago. So you come to the YU based medrash and you will instantly, David. I hope you're not wincing. I see the. But you will step in there. You will listen, and at least one individual, one rebbe that you will know in a second, really b'chol kocho. So yes, when you're talking about not the silent amida, there can be a lot of noise. But during the silent amida, again, I'm not saying there isn't. I don't know, but it's not been my experience.
In other words, people singing out loud to join the
school. Oh, well, oh, that's for sure. That problem. You're saying because you missed the words of Chazar Hashat.
You're missing the words of Chazar Hashat. You're about people who are being yotzei to Chazar Hashat.
Yeah, so the answer is yes. I mean, this only happens typically on a Shabbos or a Yom Tov. Right? It doesn't happen during the week. What I would say on that is the following. The same thing, by the way, it's relevant Friday night during Magen Avos. If you're the Baal Tefillah and the Tzibur says Magen Avos, you should wait to say the whole Magen Avos until the Tzibur is finished. Because, in theory, it's a Chazaras Hashat, being Motzi, whatever you're being Motzi, and therefore the Tzibur should be able to hear the entire Chazaras Hashat. It's true Shabbos and Yom Tov also. In a case, if you're talking about the Ikar Tefillah, right? If you're singing Chamol on Rosh Hashanah, the piyut doesn't matter. But if you're talking about the parts that are really the parts that you would say in the silent Shemona Asrei, let's say I'll take the Yom Narayim, Uvechein, 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 and the few other paragraphs, and Atavach Hartanu, Vatitan Lanu, Yalav Yavo, Maloch, the Chazan's voice needs to be audible, ideally. Because otherwise the people in the tzibur don't hear it. So you have to kind of figure out how to do that. Sometimes the chassan has a strong voice. I'm sure a cantor berzon can be heard here. But if you're an ordinary Baal Tefillah and you want to make sure that your voice is heard, or let the tzibur sing, obviously it's a much bigger problem. It's a big, bigger problem in the chasimah sabracha, in the concluding part, because that's really, you're not yotzei without that. But even in the text itself, it would be appropriate. Anything that the individual would recite the Yachid would recite. That's not additional to the Chazaras Shatz, and that's the only times you really have the additional stuff is Yamim Noraim, right? I think Shabbos and Yom Tov, pretty much. Maybe I'm missing something, but outside of Kedusha, everything that the individual says in his private Amida is repeated again. So all of that ideally should be audible. Yes. The criteria, I, at least, if you ask me, and that it's been, it's the Psak in our shul, and I think, I suspect this is relatively broadly held of that in Chazaras Hashatz, you do not repeat, in Piyut, you can repeat. So, you want to repeat it in the Sana Tokef, that's fine. And if you want to repeat in Ein Kitzva, that's fine. But you don't repeat in Uvachains, you don't repeat Chas V'Shalom, and I've heard it, in the Chasima of the Bracha. Melech HaKol, and it's like, I cringe. It's okay to sing as long as you make sure you work out that the words get said once by the Chasim. Okay. I hope I'm not stepping on any practices that might occur here, but that is actually proper practice.
But same experience. I used to sing that Melech HaKol, and now I try to. The congregation does it, but I have to slow it down because I don't want to do
the. Right. It's the same thing, by the way, in the Sheva Brachos. When in the seventh bracha, the appropriate thing, and if the audience is clued in, is if they're going to sing in the seventh bracha, whatever they're going to sing, the Baal HaBracha pauses. They pick up on the cue, everybody gets the singing out of their system. I'm not making fun of it, it's beautiful. And then he continues and recites the Nusach HaBracha that everybody can hear. That is the way it's done properly. Okay. Okay, so then we get to drinking. So the Gemara had said, Mikan Sheshikr Osur Lispalo. Eli thought that Chana was drunk, and he said, Ad Mosai Tishtakarin. And she tells him, well, that's the one part. So the Gemara says, Mikan Sheshikr Asur Lispalo. So the Shulchan Aruch writes, Shasa Yayin, this is the third source, Kedei Revius, Al Yispalo Ad Sheyosir Yeno. You're not supposed to daven until you, I don't know what a good English translation is, but to the effects of the wine, what's that? To you sober up. That's a good translation. To you sober up. The Imshasa Yoser, if you drank more, not just you drank a revius. Imhu yachol, how do you know? Well, imhu yachol adaber lefnei melech, if you are coherent enough in order to speak in the presence of the king. Well, we're not defining how you determine that, but if that is the case, im hispalel tfilas tfilah. You're not supposed to daven, but if you did, your tfilah is valid. You don't need to daven again later when you totally sober up. If you're not able to speak in the presence, you're not coherent enough, then your tefillah is an abomination. You have to daven again later. This is always one struck me. I remember many years ago, a chaver of mine, he and I came back to YU, in the evening, late afternoon in Purim, and a third friend of ours came back totally smashed, but clearly a very sweet drunk, and he came to the base marriage. He wanted to daven Marim. So this Chavar and I, who's now a prominent Ram in an Israeli yeshiva, we had to kindly walk him to his room, explain to him, you're not allowed to daven, and that is what we did. But as I understand, which you don't need that experience to understand, but I grasped immediately is the problem is that someone who's shikr and eno yochol daber lefnei melech also doesn't have the capacity to understand that the shikr and eno daber lefnei melech and they shouldn't be davening. It is a beautiful thing that they're shikr, where they can't be daber lefnei melech, but they want to daven. So that is very nice, but nonetheless, that would be prohibited.
Well, that's nicely aligned with what you're saying, because it doesn't say usher with power.
It says, yeah, I guess. Maybe, it might be correct. Okay, good. Right, if he davened, then he obviously had no capacity to decide, but he should realize later he has to daven again. Let's say you got drunk, and you couldn't daven, and now Zman Tefillah has passed. Mashlim oso betfila shacharah kedin shogeg. This is treated like a shogeg, like someone who missed davening by accident. You forgot, and then you daven again. We don't treat this person like a mazid. You know, they shouldn't have gotten drunk, and therefore they can't replace it, because we passed him. We learned at the beginning of the fourth parak that if you intentionally don't daven, you miss a tefillah, you can't make it up. But if you, by mistake, you forget, and you get distracted, whatever it is that accidentally, unintentionally, you miss the tefillah, you can make it up in the next one. So this person, this shikur, is allowed to make it up in the next one. And then the Rama adds, v'din kriyashma k'din ha-tefillah, aval shar brachos yochol avarech, aval pishu shikur. So this was based upon, I don't know if we read it, but Tosfos quotes Yerushalmi. Tosfos on our Amar Alam and Aleph Amid Beis, when it says, it actually belongs to Amid Aleph, but the Tosfos is printed on Amid Beis. I guess the printers didn't do a perfect job of lining things up here, or it was very hard to do it. So Tosfos writes that there's a Yerushalmi. If you turn to your Gemara for 1 second, on Lamed Aleph Amid Beis, Mikan Sheshikr Asu Lespalo, Tosfos says, Yerushalmi, B'Meseches Trumos, Perek Kama, in the first Perek of Meseches Trumos, Rabbi Zera Bo'i Kame de Rabbi Ami, Shikur Mar Shevarech. Rabbi Zera asked Rabbi Ami the question, can a Shikur say Birchas Hamazon? Amar, that he responded, Mi Ochalto V'Savata Uverachta Va'afilu Midum Dam. The Torah says, you eat, you're sated, you make a bracha, and even though you are Midum Dam, which means literally dozing off. Peirush, v'afilu hu shasui v'shikur, Tosis explains, what does it mean he's dozing off? Even if he has had wine, even if he is inebriated, kol kach she'ena yochel daber l'karoi, even though you are that intoxicated, dehachi mashma v'savato v'rachta, that's what people did. They ate. When they ate, they drank. They would be somewhat inebriated. And nonetheless, the Torah says you bench, because that's expected, right? You're expected to prepare for davening and to come in and not be drunk. Same thing for Kriyat Shema. But Birchas Hamazon, by its very definition, assumes that you're going to be drunk. To pull an interesting parallel to this, there is a halacha, we learned this halacha, I don't know if we spoke about the mezuzah question, we might have. You're not allowed to learn, you're not allowed in a room where there's a Sefer Torah or Tefillin, a husband and wife are not allowed to have sex. Right? That's considered, it requires a certain covering, it requires a certain mechitza. Here's a question. Does that mean, therefore, you shouldn't put a mezuzah on the master bedroom? Because after all, the husband and wife, you expect to be having sex at various times, and there's a mezuzah there, and a mezuzah has the same essential, more or less the same parsha of Tefillin and Sefer Torah. So why is it different?
I don't know the answer. Intuitively, the answer is different.
Correct. The Aruch HaShulchan says, he quotes some who talk about, should it be covered? And he says, no, the mitzvah of the Torah was to put it on every room, and the Torah understood that there were going to be rooms in which this type of activity is expected to happen. It's a mitzvah. And therefore, there is no problem with doing that. There's no obligation to cover the mezuzah. Our mezuzahs are covered anyway, and a lot of our rooms, when you close the door, the mezuzah happens to be on the outside. But fundamentally speaking, he says it's not a problem, because that's the definition. If there's a mitzvah to put a mezuzah on the husband, on the bedroom of the husband and the wife, then it means that there's no prohibition in that context. Your tefillin and your sefer Torah do not need to be in that room.
Also, it reminds you to follow Torah mishpacha. It's a constant reminder.
Yes, but maybe you know, you have the reminder elsewhere, and then you...
But it's a mitzvah, though, on Shabbos.
Ona is most certainly a mitzvah, but the point is that in this context, because the Torah, this is, again, it's a definitional thing. If the Torah tells you bench after you eat a full meal for many people means having drunk alcohol, therefore there's no prohibition of making Birchas Hamazon, and the Rama says other brachos, except for Kriya Shema, when a person is drunk. Obviously, they have to be able to recite the words. If a person is shikr kishikrus or shalot, it's not a question of whether it's mutar levarech or not. They're incapable of actually making a bracha, so it's kind of irrelevant. You know that sometimes Occasionally, it takes me multiple attempts to say Kriya Shema on Friday night. When I lie down in bed and I decide I have to repeat Kriya Shema because we davened before Seis HaKochavim, and I there are occasions in which I find myself, I make it in the second parsha, I lose my track, got to start all over because you're in that medum dam state, and then you're not drunk. But obviously you have to be able to recite it, you have to be coherent enough to recite it, but whereas Kriya Shema and Tefillah, there's a prohibition of being inebriated when it comes to Tefillah, and when it comes to Brachos, Berachos Hamazon, and other things, there's no prohibition. Okay. Now, the Mishnah Berurah does quote here, I didn't put it here, but the Mishnah Berurah quotes some of the Achronim who say, people used to daven, you know. I don't know where the only time I ever saw this. It's not a practice I've seen locally, but in my father-in-law's former shul in Memphis. So after davening, the older European men, they would all every morning after minyan, they would have a schnapps. I suspect that caused them to live to a very ripe old age, but they did it after davening. The question of what if you have a kiddush club? I hope KJ doesn't have a kiddush club. Does KJ have a kiddush club? Okay, that's good.
God forbid.
Look, see, you are on the record. So the point is that one of the problems that arises with a kiddush club is that, you know, in my shul there is a kiddush club, actually. The kiddush club, officially. The kiddush club are, I like to say, the people who are not capable, don't have zitzvayish to sit all the way through shul. So when there's a kiddush after davening, they go down to prepare everything to be taken out. That's a kiddush committee, I should say, not a kiddush club, but no, that's the closest thing. But people, some shuls, Rachmana Litzlan, have a kiddush club, and they drink, and now they want to come up and daven musaf, and that is an issue. So some of the Achronim said that, you know, once you have a sitter, if you're shasa, not if you're shikr, if you're shasa, you've had more than revius of yayin, and you haven't walked it off, so then you can make it, because we're diving out of a sitter, it's not so hard to focus. The Mishnah Berurah says that that is a limud chos. He said that's not ideal. Really, you're not supposed to. It's just being malamed chos on what was a common minhag. I think the truth is it may have made a comeback because I hear there's such a thing as a Friday afternoon before davening. You know, I myth as a non-drinker, bichlal, I don't get this culture. But they drink before Kabbalah Shabbos, and it actually potentially really is an issue. Davening mincha, it's not appropriate. Forgetting about any of the other issues, chinuch issues and things like that, there is a serious halachic question of davening mincha right afterwards and davening Kabbalah Shabbos and Maariv. Not a lot. I'm a big maker when it comes to Pesach. I assume like Rav Chaim Nayeh, it's around 3 ounces, maybe a shade under, a shade above. It's not a whole lot. So you have to figure out what is it when it schnapps. I assume that would be typical.
A shot and a half. Wait,
depends on people's tolerance.
A shot is 2 ounces?
So what? A shot is 1 ounce usually.
A person is 160 pounds
versus a person is 300 pounds. So Chazal, that you're correct if you're talking about measuring blood alcohol content, and you're correct in a certain sense. The halacha doesn't see, you know, that's going to impact yachol adaber lefnei hamelach. But the idea that if you're shasui, you know, I would say probably the equivalent of shasui today is if you can feel it. If you can feel the buzz, even a little bit, that's already called shasui. Chazal codify it, and I think one has to stick to that, even if you don't feel the buzz, as being a revius. I don't know, you know, it's not discussed extensively. Is that a revius straight? Is that a revius diluted? I think they're thinking about wine. I think by schnapps, the shear is less. By beer, the shear is probably more, would be my guess. They're thinking about wine. One of the challenges, and if anybody is able to research and find out the answer to this, a lot of the Rishonim say that their wines were weaker than the wines of Chazal, right? Chazal held, we'll learn it, God willing, later in the Masecht, the end of the 7th or 8th Perek, that you're really not supposed to drink wine before you dilute it. One Tana even says you don't make a bar priyagathan on it, you make a shakal, because that's not the way it's consumed. So the Rishonim already are not diluting their wines, and they say because their wines were much stronger than ours. Now, that might be true. What I'm trying, I don't know anything about medieval winemaking and their fermentation. What I do know is that Chazal's wines, and I probably said this before at one context or another, Chazal's wines were not stronger than our wines. They used to dilute their wines 2 or 3 parts water to a 1 part wine, and we learned a long time ago when we had that shear on the sherry casks and that whiskey, that up until 1 in 6 is still considered yayin. Now, our wines, our table wines now are moving typically real wines. I don't mean the adult soda, you know, the Moscato, but the real wines are 12, 13, 14%. You can't get wine with more than 18% or so alcohol without distillation. They were not distilling their wines, which means it's possible the medieval wines were very, very weak. But the Talmudic wines, if they probably weren't even as strong as ours, but they couldn't have been more than, you know, 25% stronger than ours, which would mean that they were diluting our equivalent of wine, 2 or 3 parts of water. So I don't know, when we talk about a Revias here, that someone who drank a Revias is considered a shasui already, enough that they're really lechatchila, preferably not allowed to daven, but b'dieved it's good as long as they're yachol daven v'nei melech. I don't know how to measure that question, whether it's a Revias mazug or a Revias, you know, straight up. That I don't know. Okay. Now, moving on to the next issue of the Gemara. The Gemara, and this is not a Hilchos Tefillah issue, and as I mentioned last time, this is not codified in Shulchan Aruch, it's only quoted in the Magen Avraham in Simen Kuf Nun Vav, but the Rambam quotes it in Hilchos Deos, and that is the Gemara talks about the Haroe Bachaveiro Davar She'enu Hagon Tzarech Lahuchicha. One who sees something inappropriate that one's friend is doing, one is supposed to rebuke them. That is, now, Tosos is bothered by a question here. The top Tosos on Laman Aleph Amid Beis says the following. Peirush afal gav deleka isura de'oraisa. He says, davar she'eno hagun means something that's not a Torah prohibition. Because the e'ika isura de'oraisa, pshita. Why does the Gemara have to tell us this? Hocheach tochiach siv. The Torah says you're obligated to rebuke a fellow Jew if he or she is doing something inappropriate. Now, the Gemara in Arachin, and it's very interesting, the Gemara in Arachin is the source, that's the way the Gemara talks about the mitzvah of rebuking a fellow Jew. And the Gemara there says, it's on the source sheet, the fourth source, Tanu Rabbanan, lo sisna sachicha bilvavecha, yocho lo yakenu lo yistiren lo yikalkalenu, tamar lomar bilvavcha, sinu shebelev akasa medader. I'm going to leave that question aside. It doesn't mean you're allowed to hit somebody else because you don't like them. But the prohibition of losistas achicha b'vavecha is focused primarily on hiding one's hatred while presenting a face of friendship. Let's leave that. Now, minayin l'roa b'chaveiro davar miguna shechayiv l'hochicho shenemar hocheach tochiach. Hochicho? All right, so hocheach tochiach. You're obligated to rebuke a fellow Jew. Hochicho velo kibel minayin shiyachsev yochichenu. Let's say you rebuke somebody and they don't listen. They backslide into those ways. How do you know you have to rebuke them again? Talmud lomar, tochiach mikol makom. The double language. Hochiach tochiach. Yochol afilu mishtanim panav. You would think that you're obligated to perform the mitzvah of rebuke even if you're embarrassing them. Talmud lomar lo sisa alav chet. It's worth commenting that the pshat in the pasuk, hocheach tochiach, the pshat in the pasuk is lo sisa sachicha b'vavecha. Don't hide, if someone does something bad to you, don't hide your hatred. Hocheach tochiach samisecha. Rebuke them. Tell them what they did wrong. Velo sisa alav chet. And thereby, you will not bear sin for what they did. Presumably meaning because you hate them in your hearts. A second level of pshat may be, is hocheach tochiach samisecha, rebuke them, because if you don't rebuke them, you bear a degree of responsibility for what they do. The Gemara in Shabbos, at the end of the fifth perek, says that anyone who is able to be moche, to make a protest, and doesn't make a macha'a, is nispas al oso avon, is responsible. So if you're the rabbi of a community, and people are doing terrible things, and you don't get up there and say, this is wrong, so you are derelict in your responsibility, and you are, in some sense, nispas al osav, and you are held accountable for that sin. The Gemara does explain that of course, assumes that your macha'a might be effective. If you have a means to know that it's counterproductive, that might be different. But the Gemara here understands the lo sisa alav chet, which is totally differently. Rebuke them, but not in a manner in which you are causing them shame In other words, you can't embarrass them publicly. You tell them privately. So that's what the Gemara says. Tanya, Amar Rabbi Tarfon, Tamei ani im yesh bedor hazeh shemekabel tochacha. I wonder if there's anybody in this generation who is able to receive rebuke. Im amar lo tolkise mi beninecha, if the one giving the rebuke says, take that splinter from between your eyes, and I think it probably should be mi ben shinecha, from between your teeth. Omer lo tolkora mi beninecha. He says, take that beam out that's sitting between your eyes. In other words, you're rebuking me for this tiny flaw, and your flaws are much greater. And then, Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, I wonder whether there is anybody in this generation who actually knows how to give rebuke. Now, I want to sort of comment two things about this Gemara. One is just a comment about Tosfos in Brachos. I think on the Pshat level, while Tosfos is bothered by the question, why does the Gemara have to make an inference from the story of Eli and Chana about rebuke? And Tosfos says, oh, that's not talking about an Issa D'oraisa. It's talking about, and apparently davening drunk then is not a Torah prohibition. Instead, if you look at the Gemara in Arachin uses almost the exact same language. Minayin l'roa b'chaveiro dover miguna shechayiv l'hochicha. It's the exact same language, and the Gemara says, hocheach tochiach. So it's kind of interesting because the Gemara's here, our Gemara uses the word davar she'ino hagun. I don't think davar maguna has the same connotation. A davar maguna is often something that's not asur. It's something that's pasnish. It's not appropriate. It's unseemly. Not necessarily prohibited. So it's kind of interesting. So I think that's two language, eino hagun and maguna, are the same. And so I guess what Tosfos is saying is that, yes, the Gemara and Arachin ask the very same question. How do you know that someone who sees someone else doing inappropriate is supposed to rebuke them? The Gemara there quotes the pasuk there. Here, they're using the story of Chana. It must be for something else. In other words, it's not really a Torah prohibition, because otherwise the Gemara would not have used the story of Chana and Eli to make the inference. One could have, of course, argued that this story is simply a manifestation of somebody fulfilling the mitzvah of rebuke. Now, the second issue that I wanted to talk about briefly, and I think this is very, very important in a contemporary context, we don't do the mitzvah of rebuke very well. It's a hard mitzvah to do. It's a hard mitzvah to do on an individual level, especially because people become defensive. It's very few people who know how to give tochacha properly. It's especially true, I think, with our children. It's true with our friends. It's a little easier in a yeshiva with talmidim, particularly if it's not specific. When it's individual and private, it can also be difficult. Most of us, I'll speak for myself, are not always so receptive to criticism. It can be hard. We should be more receptive to criticism or not. And it's also very hard to know how to deliver a critique in a manner that it can be heard. So undoubtedly, the idea that Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah express on both ends is certainly the case. And that, I think, is true. But there is a flip side to the coin. And that, I think, is something that we do have to be careful about. And that is something which sometimes hard, but fundamentally not hard. And I draw your attention to a Gemara in the Dar. Ula b'meiske la'ara de Yisrael, when Ula was making Aliyah, or going up to Eretz Yisrael, Islavu le trained b'nei Chozoi b'hadeh. There were two people from b'nei Chozoi, I don't know if they've been named Chozoi, I don't know who they were, who were traveling with him. Apparently these two people got into a fight, and one didn't like the other. Kumchad, one got up and killed the other. He slashed his neck, slashed his throat. Amar le Ula. Ula sees this guy like he's terrified. Yeus avdi. So Amar le Ula. He says to Ula, Yeus avdi, did I do good? Amar le in. Uprale beis hashchita. He says, yeah, good job. And make sure you fully open the throat, the beis hashchita. Right? Let's make sure we see the gaping wounds. He also came to Rabbi Yochanan. When Ula came to Rabbi Yochanan, he told him the story, and he had tremendous remorse. Amar le Dilma Chas v'Shalom, Achzike Yidei Ovevera. perhaps I strengthen the hands of sinners by doing what I did. I gave him a yashar koach for murdering the other guy. That's what I did. So, amar lei nafshecha hitzalti. So no, you're protecting your own life. You didn't cause anybody to die. You're not responsible. And you did to save your own neck, and that was okay. The Gemara here, Ula expresses a concern of what the Gemara elsewhere terms machzik yidei over avera. There are certain concepts that often get thrown around polemically, certainly in the modern period, but even before, that people talk about being machzik yidei over avera. It's usur. And people may have different definitions of being machzik yidei over avera. I would be willing to bet, although I don't know that, I don't know for sure, that when this whole debate over the synagogue council, whether or not the Orthodox community should have representatives, was the New York Board of Rabbis. I forget what it was. Rabbi Lookstein will know that the Rav took.
What? Yeah, Synagogue Council of America.
Okay, and the Rav sort of stood out, and he encouraged the RCA, I guess, to have representation.
Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld.
Okay, and the world of Aguda was categorically opposed, and I wouldn't be surprised if in that context the term Machzik Yidei Over Avera would have bandied about. Now the truth is, there is an issue of Machzik Yidei Over Avera, I'm not saying in the Synagogue Council, but what Ula did was exactly that, giving Yashar Koach. Just to give a contemporary example, supposing you have, unfortunately, a member of the shul or a child who's a member of the shul is intermarrying. Now, it doesn't mean you have to ban the child from the synagogue. Every shul has its policy when people violate an avera, if they're mechallel Shabbos, if they cheat in business. Unfortunately, many shuls don't have a policy on that. They should. What do they let them do? Right. I would hope that a Michal Shabbos doesn't get Maftir Yona, doesn't get to daven for the Amot, certainly Yom Ra'ah, maybe not Shabbos and Yom Tov. They probably, in many shuls, get an Aliyah, so that should be the same policy for Michal Shabbos, for someone who cheats in business. Let's say you have someone who intermarries, you might make a different policy, but you might say the same thing. But what you would expect is that the shul is not going to put in its announcements a mazel tov to the couple on their marriage. Because that is machzik yidei over avera. That's saying yashar koach. That's what Ula did, except for Ula did it to save his life. Now, what is this prohibition of machzik yidei over avera? I think it's very clear from the Gemara it's a concern. It's clear from the Gemara in Gittin. So what is it? And I think the answer is actually very simple. It's a violation of hocheach tocheach samisecha. Hocheach tocheach samisecha typically is fulfilled. The purpose of Chayat is to rebuke someone, hopefully there'll be Porishman Avera, to express dismay that someone is doing something wrong. Now, usually that's done, it starts out as being an act of mitzvah. But we're not capable, we're not very good in most cases, or certain types of scenarios, especially with individuals, of doing Chayat HaChayach, because people are not receptive to Chacha, as Rabbi Tarfon describes, because people are not capable of giving Tochacha of rebuke that will be heard. But it's one thing not to fulfill the mitzvah of tochacha. It's another thing that when a person does an avera, instead of getting up and saying, that's an avera, you shouldn't do it, you say yashar koach. You say mazel tov. That is, in effect, an active bittul, an active nullification of the obligation of tochacha. So I think that while one can debate under, I think the example that I've chosen, I think is a pretty clear-cut example, one can debate whether or not participating with other people who have a different value system, a different halachic system, whether that's appropriate, whether that's called machzik yidei over avera. That's, you know, I presume that when the rabbis, when Rabbi Schoenfeld joined the Synagogue Council of America, he didn't tell them, oh, I think it's wonderful that you don't have a mechitz in your shul. Rather, it was a group of people who had a common agenda, which wasn't related to halacha or halachas under contempt, but there was sort of a common issues that we had. And then some people don't like it because you feel you don't want to have any cooperation with people that you differ on these substantive issues. And some people say no. The bottom line is we're lobbying for the issues that we have in common, and we make strange bedfellows, right? There are lots of, you know, Orthodox figures today who, you know, have become bedfellows with the evangelical Christians. And some people don't like it, and some people think it's the greatest thing in the world. Everybody has a different opinion, but I don't think that I would say, I think that the debate boils down to is whether it's a good idea or not, not whether or not you machzik yidei over avera, because according to us, after all, evangelical Christians are halachically ovdei avodah zarah, and how can we do anything with them? The assumption is that if we have common ground and common enemies sometimes, either people or our ideology that we have to sort of push back against, So we join arms with people that we might have fundamental disagreements on, so we can debate when is it called Machzik Yedei Ovrei Avera. But the idea being Machzik Yedei Ovrei Avera, to take Ula's example and take the example that I gave, I think is a very clear example, giving somebody Yasher Koach on an Avera, so that is an active nullification of the mitzvah of Ochei Tochiyah. It's one thing not to perform the mitzvah of Bikun Vasei because we're just not able to do it. We're not capable enough, talented enough, they don't have the skilled enough, but it's another thing to get up and to express approval, explicit approval, of an Avera.
The problem is that sometimes the example that you gave, Rabbi Weider, of somebody who gets intermarried for the shul to make a statement, public statement, mazel tov on the wedding. I agree with you. What is coming down the road, if it hasn't come down the road already, is a same-sex marriage. The difference between the two being, in a decision to marry out of Judaism or whatever it is, into marriage, that's a choice that a person made to do something that's absolutely an avera. Whereas in same-sex marriages, it's not really a choice. It is a choice ultimately. But the person is who the person is. I mean, we understand a little bit more about it today than we did 20 years ago.
I was allowing to lay Daiv Hakim Bevermiza, but I will address it. I will, because, yeah, I chose the example because I understood that would be less controversial, but you've raised it, so I will state this. This conversation that you just had with me took place last year in a smicha class with many smicha students in it, where I was on a Friday class, one of the supplemental rabbinics classes, where I came to address a particular topic not related to this, but in the discussion came up the broader issue of Torah values, and that a truly religious Jew establishes Torah values as sort of one's axis around which everything else rotates. And we often don't realize how acculturated we are, and we often don't realize that sometimes we're choosing modern over Orthodox. In the conversation, I raised this particular issue, and the instructor of the class, after I said what I said, I said that a same-sex marriage is not any different. He said the following to me. He said, "What you're saying makes perfect sense. And why do I feel different?" And I said to him, in effect, exactly what you said, that your sympathies are well-placed fundamentally because someone who's intermarrying has a choice, whereas someone who is in a same-sex marriage doesn't have a choice. That's why I believe our sympathies are well-placed. It is a positive reflection upon us having compassion for one and not for the other. Absolutely. I don't think it changes the halacha one bit. At the end of the day, same-sex marriage is prohibited in the exact same way that intermarriage is prohibited, even though I'm much less sympathetic to one. Granted, both of them are, on the surface, Torah prohibitions. It's important to note that not a same-sex act, but the prohibition of marriage, which is cited in the Sifra, the Torah Kohanim, Kimasei Eretz Mitzrayim, Asher Yishavtem Belo Sasum, and the Torah Kohanim, the Sifra says, amongst the descriptions is ish no se ish, isha ni se sle isha, and that is quoted in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, and almost everybody assumes it's a Torah prohibition. Even though there's no marriage, even though the marriage doesn't bind, it's the same thing in that sense as intermarriage. So, yes, I think we absolutely feel differently because it, one, feels much more heart-wrenching to us. But I think the halacha fundamentally is the same. We can both be compassionate at the same time, but, and this goes back to what I said earlier in this year, our first loyalties are supposed to be to the Ribon Shel Olam, and sometimes those very difficult choices that have impact upon ourselves, upon other people, upon our children, upon other family members and friends, but that I think is what a true religious personality is. So anyway, I think that the bottom line is Machzik Yedei Ovrei Avera is any situation where a person is violating halacha. Giving them assistance is what we call a favor. But this is not giving assistance. Whether you do or don't wish them a mazel tov, they can and will do what they're going to do. But the question of our wishing somebody a mazel tov on anything or any chizuk on anything which is in violation of halacha, I believe violates machzik yidei ovei avera. And if you want to understand, as I said, what is the root of this principle, it's an active nullification of the mitzvah hocheach tocheach.